we recognize that the challenges facing Rakhine State and its people are complex, and the search for lasting solutions will require determination, perseverance, and trust.
The ethnic Arakan people are fighting for greater autonomy from Myanmar's central government. The region was called Arakan before it was renamed Rakhine State. This is the same state that saw a violent crackdown by the Myanmar army against the ethnic Muslim Rohingya minority 2 years ago, prompting a mass exodus across the border into Bangladesh.
Our recommendations, of course, go beyond the current situation in northern Rakhine and include proposals relating to the protection of rights, freedom of movement, enhanced economic and social development, and the edification of Rakhine's cultural heritage.
If you're a regular listener of Inside Myanmar podcast, we'd like to encourage you to consider joining our membership program. In addition to helping us keep this platform sustainable and allowing us to produce more content, becoming a member offers you increased access, advanced releases, behind-the-scenes content, discounts at our shop, and much more. In fact, it's thanks in part to existing members that we're able to bring you today's interview. To learn more, go to insightmyanmar.org/membership.
Okay, I'm happy to be able to speak with you on my experience with Myanmar and Rakhine State in particular. For most of my working life, I worked for the Netherlands government, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, in various parts of the world, Africa, Asia, and Central America, Mexico. But I also, for about 5 years, took a leave of absence and worked for UNICEF as the head of their office in Tanzania in Africa. So I have quite a bit of, I think, multilateral experience also runs through my CV quite a bit. But I became, in 1995, the Dutch ambassador to Thailand, with accreditation also to Myanmar, Laos, and Cambodia. And that was my first experience of Myanmar at a rather difficult time in the country. And even though I did not live there, I lived in Thailand, I very frequently visited Myanmar, but perhaps more about that later. And then in 2016, Kofi Annan, whom I met when I was working in Kenya, and he was there on a very, quite a long mission, asked me and said, you know quite a bit about Myanmar, don't you? I said, well, you know, it's a number of years ago since I've been there, but I've always kept interest in it. Why do you ask? And he said, well, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi has asked me to head a commission made up of both internationals and Burmese nationals, and I would like you to be part of that. That commission. And the commission, of course, was the Rakhine Advisory Commission, which was set up in order to develop proposals for the government of how it could better deal with the decades-long tensions between the Rakhine population and the Rohingya. And I thought for about a day, and I knew, you know, from 95 to 2000 when I was there, when I often visited Myanmar, the issues related to the Rohingya and the problems of Rakhine State. And I said yes, and I knew it was going to be complicated. And it certainly was. And since the end of the work of that commission, I have been, I became a public speaker very often on issues related to Myanmar. I've written quite a bit, mostly in English, some of it in Dutch, but mostly about Myanmar, and very often about Rakhine State, which I know better than many of the other parts of the country. And I continue to do that as sometimes people say, why are you still doing it? Well, I'm doing it because people ask me, what do you think? Can you write about this? Can you help? And as long as I'm able to do that, and there's a demand for it, and people feel that what I say or what I do can help them, then I'll do that.
Thank you for that introduction. And here on this episode of Insight Myanmar podcast, we're really delighted to be speaking to Letitia van den Ossem, who has graciously invited us into her home. We're speaking from The Hague, and we're talking extensively, specifically about your involvement in this key advisory commission on Rakhine State, with Kofi Annan, who you have just mentioned, which was such a seminal piece of work, also controversial for reasons we'll get into later, but there's so much to explore with that. And before we get into the advisory commission, let's set the stage and talk. You've already explained how you had extensive experience internationally. You're the former ambassador from the Netherlands to Kenya, Mexico, South Africa, as well as other key postings. And you reference how you were in Thailand, and this was your first introduction to, obviously, anyone working diplomatically in Thailand is going to deal a lot with cross-border issues and the Myanmar situation. So that became your introduction to Burma, Myanmar. And so if we could start from there and then get into the advisory committee that you joined, if you could take us back to your first years in Thailand, your impression, and then as you started to learn about the Burma context at that time or perhaps before, what your preliminary understanding and impressions were.
Well, you know, I mean, I first arrived in November 1995, and the early 90s were really very difficult years in some ways, but it, oddly enough, there was also an economic boom. In those years, there was economic growth of 7 to 8% annually up till around 1997, 1998, I think. And so what you noticed immediately when you arrived is there was a lot of construction going on. There were a lot of hotels, apartment buildings, offices, what have you, going up, and many, many Asian, Southeast Asian construction companies operating there. And it was a time when the slog, because in the State Law and Order Council, as it was called, since 1990 or 1988. I can't remember when, but I mean that was the awful name, SLORC. I mean, I don't think they realized how badly that sounds. But anyway, they were there, and I think they believed that it might be in their interest to open up at least to trade and investment. And they did. And quite a number of companies came and invested. But then quite quickly, people started to realize, and people in the international community started to realize that the oppression remained as strong as it's ever been, and perhaps even worse, because it became more. I think the regime became more concerned about all these international influences coming in, embassies opening, hotels going up, tourism becoming of greater interest to travelers, etc. And that may be why they became more oppressive. 1995 was the year that Aung San Suu Kyi was released from house arrest. And by 1997 was the year in which both the US and the European Union issued sanctions against the regime. And in contrast to the kind of sanctions we've seen over the past couple of years, particularly since the 2021 coup, in those years we didn't have targeted sanctions, going only for individuals. No, you went trade sanctions all the way. It would affect the population at large. So particularly in the EU, there was some reluctance to do this. And remember, because in 1997, the Dutch government for 6 months was the chair of the EU. We don't have that system anymore, but in those days we did. So I went to see Aung San Suu Kyi, who had asked for sanctions, and asked her, to once again to confirm that this is what she really wanted, and expressed my concern about the impact on groups within the population who are already marginalized, who might lose jobs, who might, otherwise be affected. And she became angry and said, "But don't you know, this is what I want, it has to be done." We spoke about that for a while, but she really insisted that this was important. And I think she even said something to the tune of, "The sooner we go down, the faster we will go up."
Wow.
And I took that information back, and it was discussed in Brussels, and Brussels decided, like the US, to go ahead with the sanctions. And it did affect particularly the poorest and the most vulnerable. And they were kept in place for a long, long time. I think the EU actually kept its sanctions a little bit longer than the US. In the case of the US, I think after Obama visited, a couple of months after that, and it was actually in 2016, just after the first attacks of Arsa on the military in Rakhine State, he signed off on striking off the last sanctions that were still in place from the US. The EU took a bit longer to deal with that, and of course now especially since 2021, they've all come back. But they are much more sophisticated now than they were in those early days when it was blanket investment and trade sanctions, which even now some people sometimes appear to have the impression that there are blanket sanctions out there. No, I mean, if companies who do their business legitimately and responsibly, there's no reason to stop it, particularly if they provide employment to a large number of people. So these were the main issues that were very important at the time when I was there until 2000. I presented my credentials, as you have to as an ambassador, to Senior General Tan Shui, and that was an interesting ceremony. I think it's the only time I ever met him, because as an ambassador who came from outside, you didn't have that many opportunities. But it was not an easy discussion. But
how so?
Well, I mean, it was not an easy discussion. Of course, they were happy to see that some Dutch companies were actually preparing to invest, or where trade was starting up. Like you had Unilever, for example, which at that time was still partly Dutch, which was trading, which had a big presence in Thailand. So a lot of Unilever goods and products were moving into Myanmar. And on the investment side, you had the Heineken Brewery, which was established, built in Yangon. And which a couple of years later, you know, Heineken sold its shares because it had a co-investor, Fraser Neave, in Singapore. It sold its shares back to Fraser Neave and, you know, decided to leave Myanmar altogether until they came back again at the time that they had more confidence in a stable government. It was actually interesting because I remember in those days that I asked them what was the main reason why you left? Were you afraid of Dutch protests against you? Because the Netherlands is a small country for a company like the Netherlands. Protests in the Netherlands wouldn't affect its international operations that much. But they said very clearly at that time, it's the US, it's the US college market. We are the prime beer at the moment for US college students. And they were afraid of protests in the US. So it's sometimes, you know, you don't really think what drives these companies. But they did come back. The brewery is still there, although they don't brew Heineken. They brew various, they have various other brands that they have together with Singapore. So those were the kinds of issues that were dominant. But you could gradually see a worsening of repressive behavior and repressive violence against the population that dared to resist the policies and practices of the military government.
Can you give some examples of some of those increasingly oppressive acts that you began to see during that time?
At that time, even when I was there, it was clear that There were increasing problems with the Rohingya, for example, who had returned from their flight to Bangladesh. They left in the early 90s and then were pushed back, not entirely completely voluntarily, but they were pushed back, but the repression against them increased. it was very difficult for us to visit Rakhine State, and particularly if you were a diplomat coming from the outside. You had to ask permission, you know, months ahead to take these kinds of trips. And so I never went there at that time, but I did later. But that's one example. It was also difficult for some of the international NGOs that you find everywhere, where it's whether it's Doctors Without Borders or others, to function, although they persisted. But it was difficult. I mean, let me leave it with those two. But you noticed it, and you know, because I always try to speak with some of the non-governmental organizations there, and you realize that they became more careful in what they were saying, where they were willing to come and see you and talk to you. But it was very important for us to have these kinds of contacts.
The snapshot of your years in Myanmar, this 20-year plus period going from 95 through to 2017 and obviously beyond, this is such an interesting period of time window to look at, because you're describing when you came, that was where the post-1988 demise of the democracy movement, crony capitalism, was visit Myanmar year, I think, of 96. All of this, Aung San Suu Kyi under house arrest, all of this is...
She was released in 95, huh? I think.
Right, in and out, though. Years of house arrest before, years of house arrest ahead. Depiyin, of course, some years after that. So you're starting, you know, your involvement with Myanmar starts as this crony capitalism, greater repression is underway, yeah, and then goes through until, you become, as we'll get to later, you become this key member of this very important delegation that's assigned to looking at the causes and recommending solutions for the Rohingya crisis. Some of the themes that we're looking at, your institutional history of anything around, say, sanctions or international engagement or Rohingya or the regime or democracy movement, it's very interesting to look at what you were able to witness firsthand from the inception of some of these things when you first started to years down the line. And so taking one of those things, sanctions, going back to, I'm struck by when you describe your conversation with Aung San Suu Kyi.
She was very keen to have those sanctions, and she had already told many diplomats, in addition to myself, that this is what she wanted. So there was a bit of impatience on her side, but it's true. And you know, it's, even though she was, for some of the time I was there, again under house arrest, I was always able to see her, because diplomats were allowed to visit her, and it wasn't easy to get in. You know, it took a while to get permission, and you know, I remember, you know, the group of police people and others in front of our house making your life very difficult and saying, you know, we have you on our list as Letitia van den Assen, Dutch ambassador, coming for a visit. But the passport you just gave us says Maria Letitia. So are you the same person? You know, and then that could take half an hour. They would just, so, and then whenever you went back in, she always asked how difficult they had been. and like others, I would bring her books, magazines, mostly on political issues. And she would always say, she sometimes said, you know, the last time the postman stopped here was in 1988. And that gives you perspective of how isolated she was. But it was, I think, through the diplomatic community and a few others who were able to access her, that she was still kept informed of what was happening.
I've always been curious for any individual in that situation of how you're keeping your mental and emotional and psychological balance under, you know, that kind of isolation. I know that she practiced some meditation. She's a huge fan of suspense books, detective books. I know that. But how did you, when you would come to meet her, how would you describe kind of her mental stability in managing just that sense of isolation?
We never really discussed it, but that particular question. But I think she used, appears very energetic, happy to receive guests, well informed about what was going on in various parts of the country. So that isolation was, you know, was relative, at least whenever I would see her. But I've often thought about what she did and said in later years, and even also about the question of sanctions in 1997. What happens to a person who is isolated for so long, has been imprisoned? Are you in an extreme hurry? You know, you've set objectives, you want to achieve them. You don't always want to have time to discuss extensively with everyone why you want to have it, and you want to have it now. And I just, you look at it through my own lens. What would I do if I were in a situation like that?
Absolutely.
And that, I think that, that must have affected there. I don't want to draw any conclusions, but I think particularly of her now, you know, of course, we haven't heard anything about, we've heard about at least 70 prisoners in Naypyidaw being killed. I think we would have heard something if she had been among them. But to be there in those circumstances when everything goes haywire, having seen what's in the public domain about the kind of place she is in that prison, inside that prison area in Naypyidaw. How do you survive? How do you survive? And I mean, it's obvious that she and all other political prisoners, and there are still hundreds of them, have to be released. And I regret that when I listen to, for example, the outcome of ASEAN, the ASEAN meeting in Kuala Lumpur a couple of weeks ago, you find it hidden in a sentence in a long communique, but doesn't come to the forefront. And I hope that behind the scenes, whenever, say, you know, Prime Minister Anwar met with Minang Lang, that these questions are raised. Why do you not first decide to make a gesture that will inspire trust by releasing the political prisoners, including Aung San Suu Kyi? Who are you afraid of? And new political prisoners are being made every day. So I always, when I think of her and try to judge, I don't want to sound judgmental, but I try to assess what she's like and why she did certain things also during our time with the Anand Commission in Rakhine State. What drives her? And did she always oversee the implications of decisions that she took?
Yeah.
Like for example, appearing here in The Hague at the International Court of Justice. It's very easy to be judgmental and to say that was totally wrong. She hasn't had an opportunity to explain why she did that. Was she under a lot of pressure from the military? Had they said, if you don't defend us, there will be a coup? We don't know. So I'm careful with judging that, although I was really, you know, pretty appalled at the time, and also, you know, again, seeing when she returned the kind of reception that she received as a goddess.
Yes.
But that's Myanmar for you, you know, I mean, and that's also one of the reasons why many of us keep interested in it and following it, because we want to understand. And there are things you cannot understand that you also have to, you know, resign yourself to.
Fascinating. You referenced this meeting you had with Dan Shui, this weird, awkward meeting that was part of this formal procedure, and that was the only time you met him. And you've talked a bit about your engagement with civil society and Aung San Suu Kyi herself. And so looking at your engagement over these years with the military, with other members of the senior military, during this great swatch of time that you were connected with Myanmar, how would you characterize that?
Well, the military, apart from the credential ceremony, which was pretty ceremonial and pretty standard, my interaction with the military was mostly limited to the time of the Annan Commission. And it started right away, immediately after we landed. Late August, we were supposed to start on the 1st of September. And it suddenly turned out that Aung San Suu Kyi, who had taken the initiative to establish our commission and who had asked Kofi Annan to put together a group of people, that she had not been in touch with the military to say, hey, you know, this is happening. And so the military was very upset. They immediately went to Parliament, where they did have 25% of all the votes, and said that this commission should not be allowed. It would be allowed, but the foreigners would have to go, which would have made it like the 7 earlier commissions on Rakhine State, which had gone before us. But that, and of course they did not get that, because, you know, by 2016, the NLD had more than 50% of the vote. So, you know, so then they went to the parliament in Sitwe and put forward a similar motion there, and that one passed because the MPs there that were against this commission did have a majority, and of course there was also 25% military contingent there. So we were immediately we weren't stopped, but we were made to reflect what to do next. And I think when Kofi Annan flew in, he decided not to fly into Yangon, which is where the rest of us were, but go straight to Naypyidaw to talk to Min Aung Hlaing, to explain to him what we were coming to do, to ask for his cooperation, and because he felt he had to polish that problem there, and he never told us, by the way, what the outcome of that meeting was. But we went ahead. We had difficulties with the politicians in most of the politicians in Rakhine State, until they started to see what we're actually trying to do. We were not there for the Rohingya. We were there for all the people of Rakhine State, and to try to see how the lives and the future of all of them could be improved by bringing them together and, you know, taking a number of measures that would actually help to bring that about. So when they understood, the politicians in Rakhine State, what we were doing, they became more forthcoming. And at some point, you know, I think even in Yangon, at some point, we have a meeting with a number of high-level members of the USDP who also had wanted to see us. So, I mean, it shows that, first of all, it shows how important it is that you cover all your bases, that you make sure that everyone who has influence on what is on your mission knows what you're doing and understand that you're not against them, but you want to work with them. That being said, working with the military was quite difficult. Our first meeting took place in Naypyidaw in December. And remembered, this was shortly after the attacks of the 9th of October by ARSA on a number of police posts in Rakhine State, which really had the military quite upset. Whether they were involved in some way or another, only history will tell us. But it was not a pleasant meeting. Let me put it that way. You have to imagine, you know, two long tables, one with Min Aung Hlaing in the middle on the one side, and with about on each side five other generals, and it was like an interrogation panel. And on the other side was where our commission, there were nine of us, there were six Burmese members and three foreigners, including Kofi Annan, Hassan Salamé, a French expert, and myself. And the scene alone of all these men in green sitting there, and you know, I think our objective there was to see how we could contribute towards stopping the violence that the military had unleashed against the Rohingya after those attacks of the 9th of October. And I remember Kofi Annan asking, so when will you be finished with these clearing operations? And Min Aung Hlaing said, until we have all the guns that they stole from us back, and I think there were 49 or something like that, until every last one has been returned. So that gives you a sense of what the kind of mood was. He Min Aung Hlaing seemed very how would I describe it? Very upset and angry, or at least, you know, taking it out on us and trying to blame, I think, us for what had happened.
How?
Well, I mean, we were supposed to bring help to bring the communities together, and his intention with those awful, and the word alone, clearance operations, you know, it's like you just take a bulldozer and destroy everything in sight. We don't know enough yet, and perhaps we will know more in the future when people feel more comfortable to talk about this, or when hopefully there will still be in addition to the tribunal of the court in Argentina, which has already issued arrest warrants against Minhong Leng and others. But I hope that the ICC here will also soon do the same. The good thing about ICC is that if they issue an arrest warrant against a number of people in the military, they will accompany that with a document that is a preliminary assessment of the case. And it shows you, not in detail, but generally what it is that they have that they will put on the table once a trial starts. That may lead to further information as well. So, but if you then go immediately on to, you know, August of 2017, the day after, we presented our final report to the president, to Aung San Suu Kyi, and to the military in three separate meetings. We all know what happened. The next morning, the Rohingya started being driven out of the country. So was that always the final solution that they had set in motion? But I mean, it we don't know. I mean, we don't know. But it was very clear, because I was in Yangon for most of, and Naypyidaw for most of August of that month. It was clear that preparations were being made. It was clear that preparations were being made. From the 10th of August onwards, troops started to land at the airport of Sitwe. We noticed other things that were happening that indicated that something was about to happen. We didn't know what, but you know, we were shocked when it happened, and the pictures went all over the world about what had happened, but we were not surprised. That was not only for us, but I think for most of the international community, as well as the people around the country, was quite a surprise. The level of violence, the degree of violence, but as unfortunately as with many things in Myanmar, we're shocked for a while, and then we move on until the next atrocity, you know, asks for our attention. And it's incredible that with everything that's happening around the world, whether it's Sudan, whether it's Gaza, you know, whether it's... Why is Myanmar getting so little attention at the moment?
What's your answer to that?
We've outsourced it to ASEAN, basically. And ASEAN hasn't been able and willing, really, to do much with it, unfortunately. And ASEAN, you know, just the collective amnesia they showed, they kept on insisting that, you know, the ceasefire, which the military had agreed to after the terrible earthquake, they insisted that was in place. I mean, every day you read about airstrikes. Only one group in the country can do airstrikes, and that is the military. And ASEAN was sitting there at the level of heads of government, and, you know, showed this collective amnesia. Why did they do that? Their credibility was already not very significant, but it's for me, it's gone.
I want to go back to that question of your engagement with the military and on an individual level, because you had met Dan Shui in that rather strange, awkward ceremonial, and then felt the wrath of Min Aung Hlaing when you had a meeting with him with a delegation. And I'd like to ask you to, as far as you're able to, from brief interactions, but as a diplomat, I imagine you have some experience of gleaning character from brief interactions with people and having to make assessments on background. If you can contrast Min Aung Hlaing to Dan Shui, and anything else about interacting, being in a room with Min Aung Hlaing that might inform us more about his personality and background that we don't get so much from the headlines.
Well, with Dan Shui, it was a friendly meeting, because that's what you're not supposed to in when you first present your credentials, to immediately go to, you know, the very worst grievances that you have. That you do later on with the Minister of Foreign Affairs or whatever, what you do. But with Min Aung Hlaing, the impression was that he really, you know, I think you sort of despised us. You know why? Because we stood in his way. Aung San Suu Kyi had done something without asking for his consent, which, I mean, it's questionable whether, I'm not going to judge her on that, she didn't do it. I can't speculate why she didn't. But he could not stop us. And the parliament, you know, the 25% of the military bloc in parliament hadn't been enough to stop us either. So we went. And they had to cooperate with us. We had been planning to visit Mangdo and Butidong in the middle of October. And of course that trip was cancelled, because it would be not safe enough for us, you know, with all these terrorists sitting there, terrorists as they call them. But finally, we got approval to go there in December. And I think it's the 5th or the 6th of December, which was right around the time we were also seeing Min Aung Hlaing. We were so heavily policed, we couldn't do anything. We could speak with the border guard force people, with the local military, and some of the politicians, but not with the people we would like to see. And then, you know, an extraordinary thing happened, because we visited a village not too far from Mangdo. And as we came in, you know, a long line of four-wheel drives with plenty of people to protect us, we could see in the distance women and children. And when they realized, they didn't know who we were, but that they came running towards us. And they must have been 200 meters away. They came running. And, you know, we insisted that we be allowed to speak with them. And, you know, when Kofi Annan asks to say, stop, you know, I want to speak with you. You can't, you know, they had to agree. So we spoke to this group of women who said that their husbands were missing. They didn't know whether they had been taken prisoner. They didn't know whether they were dead. And they talked to us at length about their concerns. But that was the only time we really, one of the few times, there were a few more, but that when we were in Mangdo district, that we actually were able, you know, to speak with people. And the women were, you know, they took a risk. They took a risk, and, you know, we were aware of that because they were very blunt and very, very angry and upset, and rightly so. And we realized that. So one of the staff members tried to keep in touch. And at some point we heard that women, probably the same group, had been taken to a school and that they were there, and we were concerned about what might happen to them. And we insisted that they be released. That was the... And as far as we know, that happened. But, I mean, it was an extraordinary development to have these women coming, running towards you as sort of your very last resort.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And I think that anecdotes like that just underscore how sensitive and delicate the nature of the work was. And I think it also goes back to what you said at the beginning of this interview, that when you were asked to take part in this, you knew it was going to be difficult, and it certainly was.
It's certainly of my entire career, it's been the most complicated, the most challenging thing that I've been asked to be part of. But it was also very rewarding. Because I think that even though, you know, the day after we presented our report, all hell broke loose and the Rohingya had to flee, I think, you know, close to 750,000 of them to Bangladesh. We had been able to speak with a number of people and with groups and institutions who were keen to make sure that solutions would be found. And it's been interesting, you know, if you look at that report. People have sometimes told me that, you know, if you read it, it could apply to any state in Myanmar.
Yeah, right.
And that was precisely the point.
Uh-huh.
But we did not want to write a very detailed report. It's only 88 pages. Not 88 pages. There's 88 recommendations. Nothing to do, totally accidental, nothing to do with 1988. It wasn't some kind of reference. But, you know, it's short, it's concise. The recommendations are not very prescriptive, because what we wanted to achieve is that the people of Rakhine State and their leaders would look at this and say, now what can we do with this? Can we elaborate this? If you tell them, here's the program, A to Z, this is what you have to do, you don't get anywhere. They have to find out for themselves what is suitable and acceptable under their circumstances. But it's of course the situation is very different now, particularly also since 2023 and the 1027 operation, by which very, very rapidly the Arakan army took control of most of the state in a very surprising and massive effort on their part. And you're now dealing with a different situation on the ground, with basically only Sitwe, Chaukpyu, and Munaung Island still being under control of the junta. And it you now have a situation in which a group of the Arakan army and the United League of Arakan, their civilian wing, probably faster than they have had imagined, have to build governance structures, have to earn and deserve the trust of the entire population. under very difficult circumstances, because you know what you don't hear very much. Let me first of all say that as far as the Rohingya and how they are being treated is concerned, both in Bangladesh and in Rakhine State, there are huge issues there. But what I don't hear people say is we have to look at the entirety of Rakhine State. Mm-hmm. All of Rakhine State has people that are victims of airstrikes. Mm-hmm. That are, you know, since 2023, the junta has blocked off Rakhine State completely, both on the internet and as well as the three main roads that go into Rakhine State. Financial situation of individual families and groups is dire everywhere. They've lost their livelihoods. If you look at the people who are still in Sitwe, everyone who could leave has left. It is, you know, the UN has been warning about large-scale hunger and even famine in Rakhine. Yet we only hear at the moment, also in Bangladesh, about the Rohingya. All of Rakhine's people are now victims, and I hasten to say there are different levels of victimhood. But if you want to do something for Rakhine State, you have to look at everyone as a victim and traumatized. And again, there are different degrees of trauma. I accept that. But if you want to find solutions, you have to engage with the Rakhine, with the Maramaji, with the Mro, the Hindus, all these individual groups that are there and that have their grievances. So you have to take everyone's grievances as their departure if you want to find a solution. That's not happening. It's not happening in the UN reports, and some other reports speak of the entire Arakan or Rakhine State. But most other cases, you only find discussions about the Rohingya. What about the Rohingya? And yes, the situation is awful. It needs to be dealt with. I'm glad that we're now seeing, at least between Bangladesh and the Arakan army, some contacts that should make it possible to have further inflows of humanitarian goods, of trade, and so on, going back and forth. I hear it's improving slightly over the Naf river, but it should not only go to the Rohingya. It has to go way beyond that. Because if not, you know, the same mistake will be made that was made before when the UN, can't remember the exact year, but was attacked. Their offices were attacked because they were helping the Rohingya and not the people in the immediate areas around that. You have to do it all. And if you look at Rakhine State, it is, in any other situation, you would have the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank and the UN and others, and bilateral donors getting together and say, okay, we need a 10-year plan. What can we do in Rakhine State? How can it be rebuilt? Can we work with China on how it wants to develop the corridor? Can we look at India and its Kaladam project? Can we look at other ways to how, you know, the economy can be rebuilt? We forget quite quickly that it's only 2 years ago that there was a major cyclone that hit Rakhine State, Moka, it was called, that killed many, many people there. Not only people, it killed a lot of their animals as well. And animals is wealth. Yeah. So everywhere, whether they're Rakhine or Rohingya or the smaller groups, everyone is affected. And you need to build and restructure. How can you restructure Arakan or Akai, whatever you choose to call it? And that discussion is not taking place. And I think, you know, I mean, if you look at the priorities of the Arakan army, they now have moved into three of their neighboring states, Maguey, Bago, and Ayawadi. They're making good progress. It seems that in those states, people are actually welcoming that. And they're doing a lot of training also of the local armed groups that are there. But, you know, how far do they go? It's clear that the progress they made with reclaiming Rakhine State for themselves, with the exception of the three areas where the junta is still active, it has surprised them too. And you cannot immediately build. You cannot. I don't think they are able to very quickly build the kind of local mechanisms. They have some, but develop the trust of all the different people that need to trust them to make sure that they can actually show that they're able to, by working with Bangladesh or others, provide medical care that people desperately need, to reopen schools, to rebuild bridges that have been blown up, to rebuild the roads. That is what needs to happen. And it's only then it's going to take 10 years. It's not a matter, that's why I think the whole situation with the return of the Rohingya from Bangladesh is problematic, because it's only talk about a return, but a return to what? From one big camp into another big camp? There is no way that it's possible within the foreseeable future to, in northern Rakhine State, to rebuild the area and to build temporary accommodation for 1 million people. It's not going to happen. The other thing is that, you know, there's a lot of talk of a Rohingya conference coming in New York. I think it's planned for the 30th of September. But what is being discussed in the preparations, as far as I can tell, is only the Bangladesh perspective. Yes, the largest number of Rohingya in the world live in Bangladesh. And yes, it's understandable that Bangladesh wants to find a way to return them. But there are, you know, in total, there are approximately, officially, the figures I've seen from last year, is 2.8 million Rohingya bound to world. There's a very good report by Doctors Without Borders called Behind the Wire, which has not gotten much attention, which gives you the numbers of the Rohingya around the world. And you know, when you talk about the future of the Rohingya, you have to talk about all of those, and no one does that. It's odd, because 220,000 of them are in Malaysia alone. Increasing numbers are in Indonesia. There are several hundred thousand in Pakistan, in Saudi Arabia, and in other places around the world. But we're only looking at Bangladesh, at least in most of the stuff I read. It's about Bangladesh, not about the others. And at the same time, what we're seeing is India pushing back Rohingya into Bangladesh. So if you do not address the situation as an international community in India and in all of these other countries, how are you going to solve the problem? You're going it's going to get worse.
This is enormously complicated, as we all know, and you're just laying out further complications and nuances with it. And I want to go back to the beginning of this advisory commission that was formed that you were a part of, and Kofi Annan specifically. And because there's this history of international individuals who come in and try to engage in Myanmar in one way or another, and the challenges that they face there. So I think it's worth taking a moment and looking at his particular history with Myanmar, his reason for choosing to engage, his relationship, as far as you could tell, with Aung San Suu Kyi, and your collaboration with him on this commission, how you saw him engage and better understand in what ways he was coming in to lead this commission, and then his activity on the commission as well.
I Suu Kyi called him, and they didn't know each other, but they were both Nobel laureates, and she asked him to do this. It took 2 to 3 months to work out terms of reference that both agreed to. Because at first, you know, she wanted him to chair a completely Myanmar commission, which he wouldn't do. He wanted to have it his own way. She wanted to finance everything, so that it gives you control. That's what she did with our follow-up commission. She financed that completely, so that, you know, she could. He didn't want that. And I think, what they both agreed on is that it should be 9 people, 3 foreigners. Clearly, a Myanmar majority, because these are their issues. And him paying for some of the local costs were paid for by the Myanmar government, but most of it came from contributions to the Kofi Annan Foundation, which gave him more leeway to say, I want to do this, I want to do that, you know, I want to engage a consultant without having to ask permission to do it. So there's actually a publication issued by the Kofi Annan Foundation a year after we left, so in 2018, which describes, because he found it very important to leave a record of how this was done, how it was put together, how it functioned. He knew what he was doing. And ultimately, you know, people don't say no to Kofi Annan. Even though Min Aung Hlaing could be nasty, he didn't refuse to receive him. So, and it was, of course, for all of us in the commission, quite an inspiration to work with him directly on this. He was not there the whole time. He came 3 or 4 times during the year, left a lot of the day-to-day work to those of us who were there. I wasn't there the whole time either, but I went 6 or 7 times over the year, and then mostly for several weeks. So and working from home the rest of the time. But the reason why we, you know, one of the things that's really important that's also in this list of issues that was agreed upon ahead of time, we would not vote. Our recommendations, our report would be driven by consensus, because that was the only way to do it. So it's these kinds of things that ultimately, I wouldn't say made it fully successful, because, you know, the day after we left, we handed over our report, the Rohingya were driven out of the country. But I think that report was written in a way that makes it acceptable to everyone. You can't just then completely reject it and say it's nonsense. And often people still refer to it. I mean, every single General Assembly resolution on Myanmar, UN General Assembly resolution on Myanmar since 2018 has mentioned that report. I'm not saying that it doesn't need reflection. Some things have changed. Some things have not. And but to give you an example of one very important recommendation that's in there, it's the one about citizenship for the Rohingya, which is very important. And it clearly says, without being prescriptive, that it has to be reviewed. It's no longer functioning. It has to be reviewed. But you, if you would have said, these are the conditions to which a new law should adhere, you would have gone too far. But and this is, and I want to mention this. It's important. In early, I think it was by immediately after the coup. The NUG, in the immediate months after the coup of 2021, the NUG made a statement suggesting that it would be in favor, or at least look seriously at citizenship for the Rohingya. And that was welcomed by the international community. Since then, there seems to have been a change of opinion within the NUG and the NUCC. And of late, what we've been hearing is that there is no agreement on this. And the NUG spokespeople have been fiddling around with it. This is what I find one of my biggest disappointments. If the NUG cannot agree that all the people of Myanmar are equal before the law, then it means that, you know, that the Rohingya should also qualify. Many of them, you know, trace their origins back to at least 1948, but, you know, in many cases even centuries longer. And it's clear that they have been kept away from citizenship for political reasons. The problem is that when people talk about citizenship, they mention the Rohingya. As a matter of fact, it's not only the Rohingya who are affected. It's many, many more people. It's the people who are ethnic Chinese, the Hindus, the Nepali, many of the smaller tribes. You know, according to 2014 census, 25% of Myanmar's people are undocumented and could be stateless. Mm-hmm. You know, or have no way to prove, to establish that they're. So this is a huge issue that has to be addressed. Now, it is, when I asked about a year ago, a little over a year ago, an NUG minister who was visiting The Hague, I mentioned this and said, you know, what's happened? Where is the law? What is happening? He said, well, you know, We didn't want to be too prescriptive. We thought we had to leave some issues open for discussion. That's a terrible answer to give. At least he could have said, we're all for it. We're doing our best. There are details to be ironed out, but you know, this is important. That is leadership.
Yeah.
You say, in principle, yes, but, you know, there are things to be discussed. We're not there yet, But if you say, no, we didn't really want to do it because we didn't want to be too prescriptive at this stage. And there are some good people, like, you know, the energy minister for human rights and his deputy and others that probably think very differently. There are also more and more articles now coming up about this. And some very good scholars who are writing about this. But you cannot be taken seriously by your own people. And it, you know, I mean, if you look at the young people who've taken to the jungle and who are fighting, and who are being helped by quite often by the more experienced forces of the ethnic armed organizations, they no longer look at these issues in a very isolated way. My tribe, no, they're fighting for a bigger thing, and it's very tragic, I think, that some of the more experienced and respected people within the NUG would actually not be able to push this vision through. Yes, and it's for everyone. How we'll do it, you know, we need to see. Do we need a new law? Can we amend the existing law? I mean, that's fine. We have to change the constitution. Yes, work on it, but state the principle.
What do you attribute this failure to?
I'm not sure who are the people that have. There's some difference between the NUCC and the NUG. There may be some of the ethnic groups, including the Rakhine, who might be pushing back against this, although this is not what the leader of the AA has been saying. He's been more forthcoming, although, you know, confronted over the past year with Rohingya who were conscripted, often against their will, to fight with the junta against the AA. We've seen him, the AA leader, saying things that are going in a different direction. But in principle, that statement also stands.
Now, going back to this commission, you reference the six Burmese nationals and three foreigners, and you're together analyzing the information, understanding, making recommendations. How would you characterize the relationship between the foreigners and the Burmese? Were there points of division, or do you feel that that you were able to talk about things and come to relatively similar conclusions?
I think we came to a lot of conclusions. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't all have signed off on that document. It's a give and take. I can't say much about the work within the commission particularly with the local members. You know, on the 8th of February 2021, a couple of days after the coup, Min Aung Hlaing made a statement in which he said he was going to go after the commission. And as far as I know, of those six members, at least four are still in Myanmar. And I wish them well. Because that was very unpleasant and very unnecessary. But it showed, on the 8th of February, in his first major speech, he said that, how badly he had taken the work of the Annan Commission. And that if he wanted to take revenge, that he would be able to find him. So that is, it was very personal. Nobody ever said no to him. It's not that we said no. You know, we were very polite, very diplomatic. But he couldn't have his way. He couldn't have his way.
Now, one of the criticisms of this commission was that it did not have a mandate for investigating human rights abuses. Can you comment on the rationale behind that?
You need a different commission for that. This we were more we were not blind at all to what was happening, but our mandate was to find a way forward. And that's what we try to do. You need people with forensic experience, who know how to deal with witnesses, which is very difficult thing to do, provide the witness protection and everything that is needed to make sure that nothing happens to those who come forward. It's not the same as the title of our report says, you know, it's towards a peaceful, fair, and prosperous future for the people of Rakhine. We look forward. Didn't mean we to look forward, you have to look back. And there are plenty of reports that we also read from, whether it was Amnesty International, the International Commission of Jurists, excellent local organizations that we worked with. So we knew that. We knew that. But we weren't going to investigate that further. We had neither the time nor the capacity to do that. But it needs to be done. And I think that at the moment I see two independent investigations that are still necessary. One is in Bangladesh, the other one is in Arakan. There are many questions about what happened in northern Rakhine State, particularly in Buthidan, in early 2024. A lot has been written about that. A lot of it is not credible. Other stuff is credible. What we really need is an independent investigation into what happened in Buthidan, where many Rohingya homes were set on fire, people were killed, and so on. That needs to be... Not much has been written about it by people who've actually been on the ground, and this is the problem. It's difficult to get to Rakhine State, and perhaps, you know, the Arakan Army should be more open to people who want to do these independent experts, who want to do these kinds of investigations. What is really important is that what people do not take into account enough, and you know, with all my respect to the Rohingya around the world who are working on these issues all the time, the Arakan Army had not expected that the Rohingya Solidarity Organization, ARSA, and others would actually become instruments for the junta. And that, you know, one of the biggest winners of all the mess there is the junta. They have succeeded in making sure that the two communities were put against each other once again. There was, of course, the junta, using Rohingya in their fight against the Arakan army. There was also ARSA and RSO and others themselves. Rohingya fighting Rohingya. And you are the AA. You see a huge crowd of people. Who are they? Where did they come from? Who is who? It was a very difficult situation. And because it was so complex, it deserves independent investigation, what happened there. The other investigation that has to take place is one in Bangladesh. How on earth was it possible that 3,000 to 5,000 Rohingya, and that figure comes from a December 2024 Reuters report, 3,000 to 5,000 Rohingya could just go across the border, join ARSA, you know, the junta or RSO or whoever, without anyone noticing. How is it possible that all of these militias were freely floating around the camps in Bangladesh? So, you know, who in Bangladesh can take responsibility for what happened? And of course, we do know that, you know, the influence of the Bangladesh military has been significant there. I'm not pointing any fingers. I would really like to say that an independent investigation is needed. No one talks about this. Everyone tiptoes around what happened in the camps and how is it possible. But that needs to be sorted out, because how can the Rohingya trust, the Rohingya in the camps, trust those in Bangladesh who are trying to make sure that they are repatriated? How can they trust them? If you know that people were taken there, you know, their sons were taken under false pretenses of citizenship to fight on the side of the junta. So it takes the two sides, both in Arakan and in Bangladesh. And we've seen there are tensions between the military in Bangladesh and the government. Let them resolve it. But it's not good. And again, 3,000 to 5,000 Rohingya, and this was the figure as of late 2024, having gone across the border. I mean, did nobody... Is everyone blind, even at night, when they cross the river to go across?
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, something's going on.
Oh, it's a human trafficking racket as well. Mm-hmm. And that's the other big problem, of course, that everyone, whether it's the Rohingya organizations and apparently also some folks in the AA, as well as, you know, the usual rackets that you have on that border, that the upsurge in ships, rickety ships, unseaworthy ships, taking off for Malaysia or Indonesia mostly. Again, you know, you're talking about 200 people on some of these vessels being taken to their death. I mean, in the last month alone, 274 died. Where is the noise that we had in 2015-16 when we were talking about the trafficking of human beings across the Andaman Sea and beyond? The Bali process, you know, all these processes that were in play, nobody talks about it anymore. It's taken for granted. And it bears testimony to the anxiety and the hopelessness amongst Rohingya, both in Rakhine State and in Bangladesh, who no longer have any. It's the last hope that they have. And many of them die. I mean, I think this week I was looking at some of the figures, and the UN says that probably 1 in 5 of people fleeing across the seas do not make it. It's a huge number. And they know it. They take that risk knowingly.
Yeah, this is an ongoing catastrophe that that your commission back then was charged with trying to help find the solutions, and it's only gotten worse for any number of reasons. And going back to that commission that you were on, you were charged with both understanding, as you say, you have to understand the present and the future. You need to go back to the past. So you were charged as a commission with understanding the roots of some of these problems and then suggesting solutions, possible ways forward of how they could be resolved. And you referenced one of the findings that you had looking at returning to look at the 1982 citizenship law, not requiring certain changes and prescribing what needed to happen, but recommending that this was one of the roots of and questions of concern, and that going forward, something has to be done with this. I'd like to prompt you to go into some of the other solutions that you recommended at the time, as well as some of the past points of problems and historically that you also brought to attention.
Yeah, you know, some of the things we expected, we knew it, citizenship would be a difficult one for the government. But, you know, it was in May or June 2018, a couple of months before Kofi Annan died, that we had a final meeting of the commission together with some experts to look back. And, you know, the minister who was in the minister in the Suu Kyi government, what's his name? He's still the minister for humanitarian affairs and disaster, etc. In the present NUG government, he said, "You know, we have adopted the report. We're implementing it, but there are 8 of the 88 recommendations that we have a problem with. One of them was citizenship. That didn't surprise me. But there were others that really surprised me. Some of our recommendations dealt with setting up at community level structures that would allow people to deliberate, to get together, to discuss issues as part of, you know, regular village life where you try to sort out problems. They were against that. They didn't want to adopt that. I never quite understood why. I never got an explanation. But anything that was to happen at a lower level where it really matters, they were not prepared to accept. And there were several of these recommendations that dealt with the local level. At some point, Suu Kyi actually said, I think it was during a visit to Indonesia, "Oh, we've implemented them all." Even though you know that to have something like this, perhaps it's the Myanmar way of looking at it. You know, you organize a workshop and you tick the box, problem dealt with. That could be it. But this was meant to be elaborated and be discussed widely. It didn't happen. Now, I'm sympathetic to the extent that the Suu Kyi government didn't have much to say in Rakhine State, because, you know, the NLD didn't get sufficient votes at all. I mean, it was fairly limited. The Rakhine voted for their own parties. So most of and there was a lot of resentment because Aung San Suu Kyi actually insisted on appointing the chief minister there, even though her party wasn't the biggest.
That's right.
So, I mean, she really, by the time, you know, we finished our report, didn't have much credibility locally. And, you know, of course, Rakhine was a bulwark for the military anyway. very heavily militarized, and the military always having had a lot of say there. So there wasn't much that she could do from the central level. But, I mean, doing nothing, or almost nothing, and just saying that you've done it is something else.
But what's ironic about this is that she was the one that formulated the idea for this. She was the one that reached out to Kofi Annan, that wanted
Yeah, but it got her in trouble with the army.
Mm-hmm. Because the way she went about it was not to.
Well, two ways of looking at this. Had she consulted the military ahead of time, she would have been told off.
Yes, yeah.
And there would have been no report.
Exactly.
She didn't. And despite all odds, we worked and got some things done. It wasn't perfect, but it's a workable outcome. And at least that is there. And it was also very helpful for the Rohingya, ultimately. So it's I think that, you know, I think it was after 9 October 2016, when the first attacks took place, she was on a trip outside the country. And it took 6 weeks, for a month to 6 weeks, I'd have to look it up, before she actually said anything. She was probably very much taken aback, if not shocked. And these clearance operations started. Maybe she was waiting for those to end. She didn't have her own sources of intelligence to tell her what was really happening. So she kept very quiet for a long time.
So did you ever get her sense of what she thought about the finished report that she herself had initiated?
She thanked us profusely, but that was, again, but she must have known by the time that she said goodbye to us that this was going to be very tough for her with the military. There is a recommendation in there that speaks very strongly to the importance of separating military and government, for example. And it's clear that, you know, the military didn't like that. By the way, not Su Xi, but Minhang Lang, in our final meeting, had pages and pages of amendments that he wanted to make. Pages and pages and pages. Mm. And Kofi Annan kept saying that, you know, he would welcome any factual errors. Please give them to me. We will look at them and let you know. But this is our report. We are an independent commission. We cannot entertain any substantive changes in the document. And he kept coming back to it, Minhang Lang. So even then, you know, at the very last moment, he still was trying to, and he had, you know, it was really, it was almost every page there were changes.
Wow! So he was really adamant and engaged in this commission.
Yeah, in his way.
You said something a little while back that caught my attention about looking at both the crisis and situation at that time, as well as post-coup and what's happening here, that in another kind of situation or reality, you would have engagement from the World Bank and from China and from other actors and what it would take to rebuild. And that caught my attention because we recently did an interview with Ellen Goldstein, who was the country director of the World Bank in Myanmar and who wrote recently published a book, Damned If You Do. So you're familiar with the book and you're familiar with the argument and the personal and World Bank crisis that she had at the time, of trying to figure out how to tie in development goals with the promotion of democracy and civil society that occurred at that time, and that ultimately ousted her from her position and from the World Bank. And so I'm really glad that you read that book, because that fits into the line of questioning and reflection that I have in my mind. As you're looking at what the World Bank was doing and could be doing now, and you're also familiar with the arguments that she laid out in that book of what the World Bank has traditionally done and then what it could or should be doing in the Myanmar context, what are your thoughts on where the World Bank could be engaging at this time in a way that would be most helpful?
Well, the problem is that, you know, the World Bank and the UN agencies are part of a very state-centric system. Mm-hmm. And everything they do needs the approval of the central government. And this is why, and Rakhine is a case in point, it is so difficult to get people to think about, let's be pragmatic. Yes, there is a government in Naypyidaw, but Bangladesh sits right next to Rakhine State. There are issues there. We would like to, you know, start up trade because it's in our interest as well. We want stability across the border, which means we have to talk to the AA, even stopping short about full recognition. But there are very pragmatic ways of working together. That's easier to do for NGOs and others than for the World Bank, which needs the signature of the government in Naypyidaw. You can look at other situations, two other countries, China and Thailand, which are much more pragmatic in how they deal with the neighbors, but that too has its limitations. And of course, in the case of China, it's now going rather far, where China is increasingly trying to tell the ethnic armed organizations on its borders what to do and what not to do. We've seen that with the MNDAA and Lasho and all these kinds of things. So it is you have to feel your way forward and to see what is possible. You know, the messy situation in Bangladesh where there's suddenly talk about a humanitarian corridor or safe zones or this or that, which all have specific international meanings and which tells people hands off, you know, you don't just, you know, make sure that you open the border to trade and to humanitarian and relief goods, so that, you know, your neighbor stabilizes. You don't have to call it a safe zone. Safe zones particularly, and then, you know, I think in Bangladesh some people were calling for the involvement of the UN in that. Will you think you ever get the UN Security Council to authorize a protection mission in Rakhine State? No, that's not how it works. But you do it step by step. You have to be pragmatic and take your own interests seriously. And in the case of Bangladesh, you know, I have no problem with them exploring together with the Arakan army what's possible in terms of a return of the Rohingya. Not at all. You need to do that. But as you've seen also, that in Bangladesh, you know, the opposition has come out very strongly against it because they weren't consulted. So, I mean, pragmatism is the way to move forward. And pragmatism would also mean that gradually you can allow more aid agencies and NGOs back into Northern Rakhine State to help out, and particularly in terms of health, education, social services that need to be set up. I mean, now for every ailment that goes beyond what a nurse can do, a nurse without medication, you have to go to Bangladesh. That's hugely expensive. You need permission to get across the border and back. It's only a few people that can afford that. So it's really important to explore how far you can go. What is an issue, and I think I mentioned that already, is the lack of capacity within the AA to channel all these needs. There's some good people there. They have their own organizations that looks at humanitarian assistance and development, but it's not easy to, you need massive personnel to do that, and to at the same time to make sure that relief goods are distributed evenly amongst the different groups that are in need, and to maintain, to keep the people's trust in that what you're doing is what's in their interest. That takes a massive capacity in terms of personnel, and that is not there. But that means that you have to look at the ULA and the AA to open their border to more people who can help out in the domain of social services and agriculture, things like that.
Now, when you worked on this commission, this was an enormous involvement and investment on your time, and it's been nothing short of a real roller coaster ever since it came out. I mean, the day after it came out, you had the attacks, which drew the attention away from the reports and what you were issuing into a whole other reality. And then, of course, several years later, we have the coup. And I mean, those are just some of the major big events. There's so much more that we can point to that has gone on. And I'm wondering a couple things with this. I mean, one, I'm just wondering your own personal feeling, emotional feeling with, having put together something that you put so much work into and then such a shifting and changing reality after, and how you feel about the work that you produced, and then moving into its relevance and looking at, with all of the really unpredictable and unexpected changes that have happened since that report was issued, to what degree you're looking at the continued relevance of what you put together, given how much has changed, or if you feel that it's the more things change, the more they stay the same kind of thing.
Well, I mean, we looked at three major issues: security for everyone, so peace basically, development, and human rights. Those are the main headings under which you can put most of the thing in the report. Development and human rights are still huge issues. Security is different because the junta is now confined to a couple of places only, even though they're very critical and important. But that you have to look at again, because the security establishments as we knew it no longer exists. But the need for peace and security is very important for both development and for human rights. And we forget too easily that for many years, Chin and Rakhine were vying for first place as the poorest state in the country. Yeah. It's been neglected for decades. It's people have had serious grievances. All of its people, their grievances may differ, But all of them have had grievances against the center. And if you look at development also, they have to start from scratch. From the only, you know, and that's why it's so important to think of a multi-year plan to tackle all of this. Because if you're going to wait until China gets going with its plans for the corridor to Yunnan province, and for Chaguyu port and the economic zone, that's going to take several years. You have to look at agriculture, you have to look at fisheries, and it's the blockade particularly of by the junta that has taken place, that was put in place in 2023, that has made the lives of fishers and farmers very, very difficult. Their livelihoods, wherever they are, in the north, in the south, or in the middle of the state, the situation is dire. So you have to start looking at that soon and comprehensively. And you know, there's things that we proposed, just to mention one example, in the development chapter. We took into account, you know, all the plans for the economic zone in Chaguyu and the seaport and the corridor, the Caladan project, Sitwe port, and all these kinds of things. And so what really is needed is a manpower assessment and plan. What do we need? What kind of training do we have to start to provide now at various levels, so to prevent that, you know, as has happened in other places. People from Yangon are hired to come and do the work with the Chinese in Chaguyu or in Sitwe, whereby already you're seeing that that's of course an Indian project, Sitwe, but you want to make sure that you have people in place who have been trained for these kinds of jobs. And the sad situation also is we no longer know how many people live in Rakhine State. At the time of the census, the 2014 census, about the enumerated people, the Rohingya, because they didn't take part, but they have a figure for the people who didn't take part. That was around 1 million. And then there was another 2 million for the Rakhine and others. We know of the latest figures that we've been hearing is that, although for a long time after the exodus to Bangladesh, the number of Rohingya stood at 600,000. It's now between 500,000 and 480,000. That's 120,000 have left. And that coincides with the figures that Bangladesh is given. So that's a large number of Rohingya who have left. But the situation also is that we don't know how many Rakhine are still left. Particularly in Sitwe and in the urban areas, a lot of families who could afford it or who had families in some of the bigger cities have left. You have to start from scratch. And I keep coming back to that. What is Rakhine now? If you look at the Mimu, you know, the website that gives for all of Myanmar and the states the latest data, no data since 2022, gone. Mm. That's not only true for Rakhine, that's true around the country. And this applies to other states as well. But where do you begin? So I'm back to the manpower planning that we recommended needed to be done, associated with training, finding support for these kinds of projects that could have started, you know, in 2017. It didn't happen. It still hasn't happened. So a lot of what is in that report is still relevant. The human rights situation, of course, has also changed, but not as much. I mean, the marginalized are still marginalized. And I'm not only talking about the Rohingya, there are other marginalized as well. So, yes, part of the report would have to, I wouldn't say rewritten, but would have to be, you may want to do a new report, not very extensively, because then you go into a lot of detail, just highlighting these are the issues that are critically important if you want to start not only the different sectors that I mentioned, but basically rebuilding your government, because that's, and a new government, which is what the ULA is trying to do. But I have no idea, because of the difficulty of getting good information about how far they are. We know about these justice mechanisms at a local level. We know about it's the important initial initiatives, but we don't know how they will fare. Just yesterday, I was reading about a special consultative group amongst the Rohingya being formed in Rakhine State, with, I think, inputs from the AA. That last thing I'm not sure of, because I read it very quickly yesterday. But these things are happening, but it's very early days. But you, in a normal situation, people from all over the world would flock there to say, now this is interesting. This is state building. This is everything we've studied for it for years. Please, no. I think, you know, we've seen enough of the experience with the so-called experts. I mean, there are many of them who are great, but not all. This has to be done carefully and slowly, so that you get the buy-in of all the different population groups that live there. But again, it's going to take years, and no one wants to admit to that.
Yeah, and that leaves us to where we are today. And I thank you so much for your time and this very informative conversation. The last question I'd like to leave you with is looking to where we stand now as we're having this conversation, and to get your sense of your balance of pessimism and optimism of where we are now, and what conditions might relate to that as you look at where we stand, what the problems are, what the challenges, as well as where there could be silver linings or hope for optimism, or maybe not, where you stand today in looking at your pessimistic, optimistic outlook, depending on how things may develop.
Well, I think there's fragmentation going on. There's no denying it.
Yeah.
And it's particularly in the areas of the ethnic armed organizations, and there have been, you know, the older ones, you know, about 20 of them. And I include the Arakan Army in that, because even though it was born in 2009, which is fairly recent, but it's well established. And in those areas, in the case of China, you know, if you think of Shan State in particular and others, and Shan State also, because it's also borders Thailand, it's a very multi-ethnic area. I don't know enough about it to see where that is going. But there are, particularly along the Thai border, there have been older groups combined with newer ones who have long years of experience in in not only security issues, and they have to fight for their security, but also are well established as far as social services are concerned. And basically talking about Karen, but even further south, you're now seeing more and more information coming out about what is happening further south also, and it's going incredibly fast.
Yeah.
What is clear is that the junta still controls a lot of things in the country, but it doesn't have the manpower, the military doesn't have the manpower to actually govern if it takes back the power in big chunks of the country, which it's trying to do now. Some of it's successful. It doesn't have the people, the capacity to actually govern those areas. What if it takes back Rakhine State? It will just, the fighting will continue. What if it takes back, particularly we're looking at now at Shan, Northern Shan also. It's difficult to predict what will happen, but there will be some fragmenting. There are very hopeful efforts underway for in parts of the country where local groups are making their mark, are experimenting with their own governance structures, sometimes successful, sometimes not. But there also, and particularly in Thailand, the government has to accept more than it is now, the Thai government, that it needs to encourage these groups in order to make sure that there is stability along the Thai border. Not to go as far as China does, you know, actually even putting their own security people inside the Myanmar border, but making sure that you do everything to facilitate trade, to cross-border traffic. And I don't know, you know, it's not clear where Thailand stands on this either. It's the borders have always been the domain of the Thai military. Still are. We don't know what someone like Thaksin has in mind and what he's whispering into the ear of Anwar in Malaysia, whose advisor he has become. But it's clear that there is going to be some fragmentation. Ultimately, will there be some kind of a national structure? Some people speak of a federal system with far, far greater delegation than most people have ever thought of. Others speak of a confederation. Some of that may happen, some of that may not happen. But you're left with a situation where, take for example, the Rohingya and the Rakhine. You know, the Arakan army is not able to say, we can give you citizenship, because it's the citizenship of Myanmar. Mm-hmm. And the more the central state crumbles, the more of these issues will be devolved or changed or remain, you know, up in the air, waiting to see what will happen. Mm-hmm. The NUG has some good people, but it seems to be losing out a bit at the moment. Some of the ethnic armed groups are just moving ahead and are doing things in their own way. But the interesting thing is that most of them still say, yeah, but we need some kind of central structure. There are certain central functions because we do not all want to be responsible for all the for all the functions of a central state. Yeah. I think the next couple of months until the end of the year are going to be giving perhaps more clarity. I really admire, you know, the many groups that have to continue to resist, both in terms of the health and education personnel, the civilian side, as well as in the larger governance areas in these ethnic areas. But I wonder how long some of the smaller military groups will be able to survive, particularly looking at also the ones in the Bamar heartland, where a lot of fighting is going on, and we're getting very little, not enough information, particularly also not after the earthquake and all the disaster that and mismanagement that brought about. But that's where it's going to be really tough. I think the next dry season, which starts when? October? Is going to be critical. The rainy season makes it more difficult for everyone to move, although for those who know the terrain, they will probably have an advantage. But, you know, there's hunger, there's starvation, there's hardly any medical facilities to speak of. Schools, you know, can no longer function. You have these awful airstrikes that continue day after day after day, and that are, you know, accepted by ASEAN as a truth that there is a ceasefire. That's, you know, what I said earlier, collective amnesia. So don't think too much of ASEAN. Look at the neighbors who have a much greater stake in Myanmar and its future. There were all these odd stories a couple of weeks ago about America coming to fight in these were Indian rumors that were being spread, very widely spread. That put a lot of people on the back foot. Forget it. I mean, we now know Myanmar people are banned from even entering the U.S. Forget about it. I mean, they're not on, but they still, I mean, the inclination of many people in Myanmar has been more towards the West than it has been towards China or Russia. So it's going to, it's very difficult for them to accept that not only the U.S. is letting them down, and particularly if you look at of the immediate effect on all the USAID programs that were scrapped overnight. But in general, there is, you know, whether it's the U.K. and the Netherlands, which is also cutting back its development assistance, there is going to be need for greater self-reliance. I hate that word because I know what it means. It means suffering. And unfortunately, my government has decided to close its embassy in Yangon. Also, if you look at Myanmar and its geopolitical situation, it's the last place that you should pull your embassy out of. You have to be on top of what's happening.
Well, that's a somber note to end on, but I again thank you so much for your time and going through all of this extensive detail.
No, I mean, because you said we close on a somber note, I think it's important that there are so many people and groups that I admire.
Yes.
My admiration knows no bounds because what many, many people in all parts of the country have been going through and are prepared to continue to go through, because I think there's no way back. They don't see a way back. There's only a way forward. And it's that is who the international community should listen to. Not to the governments in the region. Not to the government in Naypyidaw. But to the people on the ground. Because there is an enormous energy and a wish to for change. If the junta only half realized how strong the wish for change is and how unstoppable it is, it would probably give up sooner than it now seems to be doing. It's fighting a losing battle. That's a positive end.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode. As regular listeners know, we often remind our audience about our nonprofit mission, Better Burma, at the end of a show. Truth be told, fundraising is hard work, and I can personally attest that it's no fun at all to keep asking for contributions. But the reality is, the situation on the ground continues to be distressing, and our work would simply not be possible without your support. What helps us most at this time are recurring donations. This provides our team with a reliable foundation, and it helps to reduce the stress of this constant fundraising. This also allows us to focus more energy on creating impactful content for this podcast, as well as to better plan sustainable humanitarian aid to vulnerable populations. Even a monthly pledge really helps. Like, say, gift us the equivalent of, a cup of coffee each month, or consider us a streaming service that you subscribe to. Anyway, to support our cause and make a lasting impact, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation.
Yarananda, Dayananangana, Yaranayada, Yaranambodaba, Yaranamino, Dadu.